Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. You're listening to America This Week with Father Matt Malone and Kerry Weber.
Welcome back. This is Kerry Weber with America This Week. I'm joined by Father Matt Malone, and we are talking with Leah Labresco, who's a writer for the news and statistics website 538. Leah, so before the break, we were talking a little bit about how to use statistics to kind of understand the world better. I wonder if there's any interesting statistics about our current electoral cycle that you found sort of particularly telling, either about the state of our dialogue today or about, you know, who might become the next president.
Well, I think, you know, the most interesting thing for me, as for everyone else, has been kind of the way that this election has functioned as a rebuke to the party decides model, where ultimately candidates, especially in the GOP, have to convince, you know, the party elders that they're acceptable, and then eventually they'll all coalesce around someone. And, you know, this election has just kind of been a giant mishigoff for that model. The most entertaining speculation I heard is that it wound up being a self-refuting model, that, you know, members of the GOP had so often heard the thesis that they controlled the election, they didn't actually exert that much effort further on because they knew they would win out in the end inevitably, which I found kind of hilarious as a hypothesis, not necessarily supported as to why it all got out of hand for their perspective. I think the more interesting thing with regard to religion and religious voters in this election is how little influence they've had and how little those concerns have, you know, taken over any particular news cycle. I think it's hard to conclude that that, you know, shows us any kind of large shift about the influence of religious voters, and more that, once again, Trump kind of takes all the air out of the room for other candidates and other topics. And since he mostly hasn't picked religion as his kind of shocking statement of the day, it's harder for any of those concerns to break through conversations about the wall, candidates' wives, etc.
Right. And I've read that most of his, or a majority of his supporters are actually don't identify as religious either. So it's kind of an interesting group of people that is supporting him.
Yeah. So in the same way that I said it often makes sense to break Catholics down by whether they attend Mass regularly, Trump's religious supporters are more likely to be only tenuously affiliated with any particular tradition or only rarely to attend church than those of other Republican candidates. So he's got people who do identify themselves as religious, but don't kind of actively practice
right.
in a particular denomination.
I remember back in 2004, I was writing a piece for America about whether there was a Catholic vote to speak of in this country. And in the way that we were then speaking about the evangelical vote, which, you know, we've learned is much more complicated than people think. But what was interesting, I mean, and the basic idea at the time among political scientists was, well, there isn't a Catholic vote in the sense that people go into the voting booth with their Catholic faith, or their Christian faith, or Catholic social teaching foremost in their mind for the most part, whereas evangelicals would enter into the voting booth in a more deliberate and consciously Christian way. But it seems that in this election, actually, no one is really doing that.
Well, I think it's partly, again, that what the candidates have focused on haven't been, you know, issues that kind of have particular ties to religious traditions or religious communities. You know, the closest we get are questions about religious freedom. So RFRA-like protections for people who dissent from gay marriage, or the Little Sisters of the Poor case for Obamacare and contraception. So a lot of the religion-related topics that have broken through in this election cycle are kind of almost very small defensive ones, not about making law, but about finding exemptions to existing law, carving out little pockets. And that still doesn't dominate, but it's certainly a less romantic call to arms, like let's all turn out so that a few people enjoy a slightly broader class of exemptions from a law that will continue to exist.
Right. I mean, that's a long way from the early and mid 1990s, right, when we had the religious right and, you know, religious topics were very much part of the political discourse.
Yeah, there's very much not the idea that any candidate's putting forward of, you know, that kind of moral majority idea of turning out religious voters to reshape the moral conversation or the ways laws shape our understanding of ethics in the country. It's a lot of small defensive besiegement moves.
And why do you suppose that that is? I mean, is it because, I mean, it's just no longer thought to be strategic or tactically effective to talk about things in that way? It's not really no longer a way to get galvanize GOP or conservative voters, or is there something else at play?
I think some of this is still the aftermath of losing things like the fight over gay marriage so definitively that there really isn't any appetite for trying to, you know, especially after the Supreme Court case, but even there's no appetite for a constitutional amendment or anything because it's clearly not going to pass. What's interesting is that, again, kind of the abortion issue falls off the radar. Where that's an issue where there's a lot of religious engagement and a long-standing, you know, division in the nation that's persisted with ebbs and flows of how restrictive abortion laws are or aren't, but really no kind of definitive defeat in the way there's been over gay marriage. And so I think, you know, a lot of this is the reaction to losing an issue completely, as the marriage issue was lost, rather than kind of having a lot of areas to keep fighting, as it is the case for abortion.
Oh, that makes sense. Now, I wonder, I've read studies that say that sometimes suggesting that, you know, most people do something can actually influence sort of more people to do that thing. On college campuses that say, you know, most people do not binge drink on weekends. They've actually seen improvements in the number of people binge drinking. By improvement, I mean it's going down. And I wonder if there's any risk in sort of all of this polling data around the election of influencing the election. If we keep coming out with polls after poll after poll that says, you know, X number of people are going to vote for this person or that person, does that influence the conversation or the way that people are going to vote because they feel sort of either helpless that the person they thought they were going to vote for isn't going to make it and they vote for somebody else? Or, you know, does that actually change the way people view the election?
Sometimes. One important thing to remember is that even though, you know, my job is sorting through these polls and telling people about them, and my job is a very important job, most voters aren't tracking the election in that much detail this far out. You know, one of the reasons why the national polls of matchups of how would Trump do against Clinton aren't very meaningful is there's a huge swath of voters who still haven't started paying attention to the election, even though that can sound implausible with the wall-to-wall coverage it gets. And so, you know, there are a lot of voters who are really only going to tune in once the candidates are chosen, once things happen later on. So to an extent, you know, all the polling in the world can't hurt those people. They're not reading the coverage and they're going to figure this out later. You know, in a lot of cases, people who decide latest are often low information voters. So how much the pundit, you know, reaction can influence them is always kind of questionable. Because if they were watching us really closely already, they'd probably have already picked.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting, most relevant in the GOP race this year, where you have a lot of high information voters trying to vote tactically to deny Trump the nomination.
Right.
So those people are watching the polls really aggressively to figure out whether they were voting for Cruz or Kasich or, for a while, Rubio. But that's relatively unusual that you have that level of tactical voting in a primary rather than just voting for people you actually want to win who might have a chance.
Yeah. But one of the things that's interesting about the pundits is, you know, this was a year where the pundit class, the political class, the media elites, of which I'm a modest member, you know, got it wrong. Everybody got it wrong. Like everybody said that this guy, Donald Trump, isn't going to go anywhere. Right. That he's not going to have any appeal. This is a sideshow. We need to be looking at people like Bush. We need to be looking at people like Rubio. And yet here we are. Right. And I mean, was there any data that would have indicated to the people who really are supposed to be paying attention very closely, the political class, that this phenomenon was going to happen?
one of the reasons that people messed up this call, us included, is that for a while there wasn't data. Like, there was polling data about how much Trump was polling long before primaries. And at that point, that far out, those summertime polls don't predict Iowa very well, don't predict South Carolina very well. So even though we had big numbers, it wasn't a reason to trust that those numbers would last, because there were a lot of flash-in-the-pan candidates, and he looked like another one of those. So, you know, maybe like 4 times out of 5, we would have been right, and this is the time we weren't.
Right.
But I think the other thing is that, you know, everyone expected more than just what the data was going to do. People had a lot of expectations about what the GOP was going to do to really bring the whole weight of the institution down against Trump, and they didn't. You know, month after month, more ads against other candidates and against Trump, because candidates didn't want to, you know, offend his supporters and wanted to win them after they assumed he'd fade out on his own. You know, the institutional party not kind of having a clear plan about what they were going to do about this. So little by little, a lot of pundits, me included, assumed that action was going to be taken along the way, and it wasn't. So it's hard to know what would have happened. You know, the prediction we really got wrong is about how intensely the GOP or other candidates would attack Trump, not necessarily about what would have happened if they had.
Right. I mean, Ted Kennedy used to say that politicians know how to win the last election. Right.
And, oh, yeah.
Right. And that's the one we're always kind of fighting. But there were a lot of assumptions, a lot of conventional wisdom that has collapsed in this primary season.
And that's really where, you know, in this year particularly, you'll see that where the GOP designed their entire election and primary cycle to make it easier for Mitt Romney to win clear out last time. And because of that, there are a lot more winner-take-all states that allow Trump to build up a much larger lead while only having about a third of the voters, as long as the other guys split it.
Right.
Because they meant for this to be a quick coronation with no, you know, fringe Santorum candidate disrupting anything too much. And it turns out that wasn't really a good model for all elections that weren't last time.
Right.
No, that makes sense. You know, it's interesting that I think sometimes data really helps to overcome what we kind of just have this feeling is true. I think a lot of times we think we make these assumptions based on anecdotes or our own experience, but it doesn't actually extend to the reality of life and the situation. And one of your recent blog posts was kind of fascinating about this, about terrorist attacks and public transportation, for example, where, you know, if you were to read the news today and kind of think about it, it seems like this is happening more and more often. This is a bigger deal. And you found that the statistics actually show that there's been a decline since 2001 in the number of terrorist attacks on public transit and transportation hubs, but more so due to a lack of conflicts, in a sense, than to increase security, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when I spoke to terrorism researchers, they said that, you know, it's kind of a mistake to think about terrorist attacks occurring out of a vacuum, that when you look at historical patterns, it's really a map of what conflicts existed. And since I was looking at Europe and North America after the Brussels bombings, you know, you have during the Troubles in Ireland, you have little surges around the Basques, separatists, and you have just a general surge in the 70s where it was a common form of political speech to hijack airplanes relatively peacefully. You know, and that period is over now. But, you know, so a lot of the peacefulness we've seen in Europe is more there not being an active political conflict that's gone on than that security was totally fixed or anything else. So the Brussels attack, it's hard to figure out exactly what to learn from it. You know, it doesn't necessarily show us that security got worse, because it's probably been at the same level for a while. You know, it might show us that if there's a sustained conflict, we'll see a lot more attacks, but that it kind of takes that sustained level of the Troubles or the Basque to have frequent terrorist attacks.
Right.
And yet the perception among people can be very, very different.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a little bit like shark attacks where, right, you know, it's violent, it's vivid, and it's memorable. So it's a much more worrying scenario than car crashes, which of course kill more people every year, but aren't kind of treated with the same level of horror or resources devoted to stopping them. You know, I think the other thing that really comes in is that in the case of car crashes or even of shark attacks, there's no malevolent human. You know, no one wills you to die in a car crash. I think that's really where the particular horror comes from that goes beyond the numbers. you know, that these are deaths that are eminently preventable if someone didn't come in willing you harm, in a way that shark attacks, earthquakes, et cetera, are not. It feels like there's no need for this kind of suffering. It's only down to us as human beings to have caused it versus the weather, you know, distracted driving, anything else.
Right. And the numbers at transit hubs would tend to be larger, the number of people harmed. So that would get more attention and more press, probably.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, it's notable that this was an attack around the security lines where a lot of people are all clustered, you know, before any security happens. And, you know, that's a hard problem to solve from a security point of view.
Yeah. You know, it, and this also reveals, I think, the limits of data in trying to understand social and political movements with a lowercase m. You know, the, I actually know a guy, I was just in Houston, and I know a fellow down there. He's a college-educated professional, and he is the only person I know who said a year and a half ago, Donald Trump will be the president of the United States, right? And I said, why do you think that? And he said, you have to listen to people, right? And he said, everywhere I go around this town, he said, I hear people who are really, really afraid, and they're talking a lot about immigration, and they are really, really angry. And he said, and that's also a kind of data, but it's more, it kind of has to be taken into account in a more artful way, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, I think you kind of see a weird way of approaching that data in the way the primary schedule was redesigned. Mm-hmm. You know, the success of Santorum tells the GOP that there is, you know, a substantial group who weren't happy with Romney, and the reaction is, all right, well, how can we redesign it so that they don't cause problems next year?
Right.
And, you know, the lesson from Trump may well be that the GOP takes, like, oh, it's a larger, weirder group than we thought. How do we need to design primaries so that they stop having an influence on the primaries?
Right.
So it's a question of which kind of data you take, just the numbers of people, when they vote, and what it would take to cause them to not win, or what their concerns are and whether it's relevant to your party's goals to address them.
Right. And then it brings up the question of, should we be orchestrating elections so that the view of the majority of Americans does not get realized?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a good question, especially in a democracy. Leila Bresco is a blogger for Patheos and a news writer for 538. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Bill McGarvey to talk about upcoming college graduation season and what young people are looking for in work and private life. Stay with us here on America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.